This program is brought to you by McGill University. Please visit us at www.mcgill.ca.
This is the title of today's lecture. The last one, the first one, was on the phenomenon. I'm just reviewing. Some of you have been here before, some of you haven't. At the very beginning of the series, I began talking about what the phenomenon was by giving some examples. I then talked about why psychology is relevant and why I was interested. Then I went through something that took a little more time and was in the nature of what you'd get in a lecture course. It was the chronology, how people and governments reacted to this phenomenon over the past 60 years, basically. Then I went on to talk about personally investigated cases, one of which I did at the beginning, one of which I did at the end, and which will return tonight. It's the case of Professor and Mrs. X from McGill University. We'll get to that shortly. In the second talk, I went through the evidence in detail. I gave you as good a summary as I could of both classic and recent UFO cases, trying to illustrate the difference in the phenomenon as it evolved over time. And then I talked about both the skeptics and the debunkers and some of the personalities involved on what you might call the UFO scholarship side. And then briefly talked about UFOs and popular culture. Today, the third talk is just about close encounters, humanoids and the abduction phenomena. And that's where we're going to begin. Remind you, at the end of my first lecture, I presented drawings that were made by Professor X at McGill and his wife, Mrs. Professor X. My wife and I got these drawings after dinner at their house following what you might call surprise intervention by a friend of mine named Vito Hovill, who I'm happy to acknowledge as one of the local UFO investigators. Vito found a report by Mrs. Professor X in the file in Ottawa, kept by the National Research Council. She had described a sighting, asked them for an explanation. They told her that they'd seen a DC-9 landing at the Ottawa airport. She didn't believe it. Hovill found out which professor it was. It turned out I knew that professor. He told me because I was at McGill. Verna and I went to the professor's house, and he and his wife told with increasing agitation the story of seeing a distant light, which the wife first thought was a comet, telling her husband about it, which he didn't respond to. Then the light came closer as they were driving past Ottawa to Montreal. The light seemed to move even closer. She thought then it was just an illuminated water tower and somehow the movement was an accident. Then she didn't think that after the thing flew over the car and went away. And both she and Professor X saw the object and described it as these illustrations show. Professor X, having seen what he thought were shadowy figures behind the window up there, and Mrs. Professor X having seen the big windows but not noticed the shadowy figures. So that would be a close encounter of the third kind, as described by J. Allen Hynek, and one in which humanoids took place, and which humanoids were, and which was in fact very close. Now Hynek wrote his book, UFOs, A Scientific Inquiry, in 1972, after, as you will remember from the previous lectures, having been a scientist researcher for the Air Force between 1949 and 1969 on the UFO phenomenon, working with the organization called Project Blue Book. Hynek was supposed to explain the sightings as astronomical events, misperceived airplanes and so forth and so on. He was the astronomer expert. He found, finally, that he couldn't, that he could explain 85% of them, say, or 90%, but, in fact, the numbers we got out of a Battelle Memorial Research report a while ago were something like 22% remained thoroughly authenticated unknowns. That is, the people were reliable, the reports were reliable, and the phenomenon defied terrestrial explanation. Then he had to deal with the fact that some of these reports included humanoids. And he said what I've written up here, what he's written. To be frank, I would gladly omit this part if I could without offense to scientific integrity. You can read the rest. But the point is, we're dealing with unusual observations to begin with. When those unusual observations also include seeing humanoid creatures that we don't identify as ourselves, they become a little more strange, but we're still relying on eyewitness testimony and observation to tell us things about the natural world that we would not learn otherwise from witnesses. And the witnesses are basically the key to this in many cases. In the UFO phenomenon itself, as you know, there are many other aspects than witnesses. There are photographic reports, radar reports, etc., and I've gone over some of those. But we have eyewitness testimony that has to be considered seriously, and Hynek certainly was willing to consider it seriously. Now, about humanoids, the only introduction you've had to them are the shadowy figures in the picture drawn by Professor X. Here's another set of humanoids. They come from a report written in about 1968 about one of six different reports that were provided to me by the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, an organization which at the time, 1960, from the 60s on, was the most prestigious and most active UFO study group in the United States. The director, Donald Kehoe, was a former Marine pilot and very active in the field. He was also a science writer and a science fiction writer, by the way, neither here nor there. His contacts within the government were very good. NICAP was active. It was constantly tussling with the Air Force about what reports meant. And when I joined, I obviously filled out a membership form which told them what I did for a living. And because I was, as Dave Barry would say, a trained professional and knew something about eyewitness reports, they sent me six of these reports of occupants as part of my work on what was called the occupant panel, a group of about 15 professionals, trained professionals if you like, who were asked by NICAP to evaluate these reports. Now the one I'm describing here, and this is only one, not necessarily the one that fits best into the lecture, it's not the only one of interest by any means, was provided by two Navajo Indians who were working in Idaho. At the end of their day's work, they went to a bar and had a couple of beers. Nothing wrong with that, and they weren't drunk. They then drove home, drove south out of Reary, Idaho. And this was after dark, and while they were on the road south, just a couple of miles south of Reary, their car was suddenly surrounded by a blinding flash of light. It was stopped in the road where it was, and a UFO was hovering above it. In the UFO were two humanoids, the two humanoids that are pictured there. One Indian got out, he was terrified, and ran to the nearest house, which was about a quarter of a mile away. A humanoid got out of the UFO and got into the car and started jabbering to the other Indian in a language that he didn't understand. He was terrified, and physiologically terrified as well. The guy who ran to the house pounded on the door. The white owner saw a distraught and terrified Indian pounding on the door. This was 1967. The man in the house might have been suspicious, but the guy was so clearly terrified that he came back with him to the site. By that time, the humanoid in the UFO had gotten out and back into the UFO. The UFO had flown away, and all that was left was one terrified Indian in the car, one terrified Indian going back with a witness, not to the UFO, but to their state of mind, and then, after the UFO disappeared, the two Indians drove back to Reary, went back to the bar where they were sitting before, white as sheets, trembling, completely out of sorts, as other eyewitnesses to them testified, and then they called the state police and made a report to the state police. And the state police report is one of the foundations of the document that I received. My point is this. In the Professor X and Mrs. X case, you had two eyewitnesses to humanoids. In the Reary, Idaho case, you have two eyewitnesses to humanoids. Professor X, I happen to know personally, and he's a man of great rectitude, so is Mrs. Professor X. I don't know these two Indians personally. What I do know is that other people testified to their total physiological distress after this event, which did them no good. They actually went and reported it to the police, and the report includes clear descriptions of how they felt or how they reacted afterwards, in addition to which it includes reports of other people seeing maneuvering low lights in the same area on the same night. So what we have here, as a summary, is two witnesses with nothing to gain and much to lose by making this report public. They never received any monetary gain for it, and other than the publicity within the sighting, nothing much was made of it. There were witnesses to the witness's state of mind, and there was corroborating circumstantial evidence, which indicates that this was a sort of classic humanoid report. In addition to which, there was a Christian Science Monitor editorial afterwards on this, pointing out that the red man had already had a tremendous amount of trouble from the white man, and it was completely unfair that he was now getting trouble from the green men as well. So... was a tongue-in-cheek editorial, but this was after we reported the case. At any rate, the other thing about this case is that, as you can see from the cartoon, what they reported was the classic cartoon UFO. Two guys in a bubble dome in a machine that looks like an inverted saucer, and here are two guys in a bubble dome in a machine that looks like an inverted saucer. And this is just one of the many current UFO and alien cartoons in the New Yorker since the turn of the year. I think there have been about six so far. I put a couple in, and there's even one more that I didn't put in that came out just a week or so ago. At any rate, the topic is one of popular consumption, and this is just an example of a humanoid case preceding, if you like, the big interest in abduction cases. But now what I'm going to talk to you about is what you might call the index abduction case. This is the Barney and Betty Hill case from New Hampshire, 1961. The book wasn't published until a year before this Reary case, and even though it was a bit of a bestseller at the time, it certainly didn't fall on fertile ground as far as the public was concerned about UFOs. Here's the information on this case, and it involves Montreal, as you can see by looking at the very top left-hand corner of the map. Barney and Betty Hill were a mixed-race couple, unusual enough in 1961. He was a post office employee. She was a social worker. It was the second marriage for him. I don't think it was a second marriage for her. They were on their way back from a short trip through upstate New York, Niagara Falls, back across Ontario, and down through Montreal and back home. This was before the era of interstates, so they were driving on smaller roads. They took old Route 3 to New Hampshire. It was late at night by the time they were driving back. They didn't really want to stop in either Quebec or upstate Vermont, in New Hampshire, so they were on their way home. They saw a light, a star, which seemed to be moving near them, or it appeared to be near them in any case, because it certainly wasn't part of the star pattern above their on the rather clear night that they were driving down. It wasn't the moon either. They kept driving. Barney was interested in it, had a pair of binoculars in the car, looked at it, noticed that it was maneuvering, and as they drove down this rather lonely Route 3, the thing seemed to maneuver closer to them. It went behind a very prominent feature, the Old Man on the Mountain, which has since fallen off because the nose is no longer there, and eventually came rather close to the road, at which point Barney put his binoculars up, and what he saw at close range was a classic close encounter of the third kind. He saw a UFO with humanoids behind it. At that point, they were still on the road. They experienced a kind of beeping sound. And the next thing they remember was a couple of hours later, they were driving down the road about 100 miles further south. They got home later than they expected to get home. They both suffered post-traumatic stress syndromes disorder after that. They had bad dreams. Barney had an outbreak of a rash. Betty was agitated. They were, in fact, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Because it was interfering with both their work and their life, they went to a local psychiatrist who referred them to a Boston hypnotist named Benjamin Simon, very distinguished psychiatrist, a man who'd worked during the Second World War using hypnotherapy on shell shock, as it was called then, soldiers, and basically used that as a technique for developing what a classic psychoanalyst would call an abreaction to remembered phenomena that they couldn't remember under the stress conditions that produced it. It was a dissociative condition, well recognized in DSM-IV, the standard psychiatric manual, and one way to treat it, a way that in fact Freud started with, but gave up for his more long-extended talking cure, is hypnosis. At any rate, the details that Simon developed under hypnosis, he kept from them by making sure they had post-hypnotic suggestions not to remember. Everything was tape recorded, and eventually John G. Fuller, the author of the book Incident at Exeter, got permission of both the Hills and Simon to listen to the tape, to interview Simon and the Hills, and to write a book about it, which is why this is publicly known. But at the time, they didn't know what happened until the entire therapy sessions were over. And what did happen was this. Their car was actually driven off the road, under Barney's control, but not under his will. He was impelled to do it. It turned off on a dirt road along the side of Route 3 into a clearing where they came upon a large landed UFO, simply a glowing orange sphere. People, humanoids, came out of the UFO, lifted them out of the car. Barney's feet were dragging. He refused to go, but they made him go. Betty was less difficult. They went into the UFO, they were subjected to medical examinations, which I won't go into detail about. Barney had false teeth, Betty didn't. The aliens, communicating to Betty in some way she didn't understand, asked her about that. She laughed because she didn't understand. She realized they didn't understand what false teeth were. They gave her something like an amniocentesis, which hurt. And they apologized for it, more or less, afterwards. Then when they were finished, Betty said, "Nobody will believe this. So can you give me something to take away with us after this experience?" The leader handed her a book. And then other people, other humanoids, appeared in the background. They talked in some unintelligible way. The leader then communicated, and I didn't say talk, with her, and said, "I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to give it to you. You'll have to give it back." So Betty didn't get the book, didn't take it home with her. They were taken back to the car, made to go back on the road and drive south, and then the beeping sound occurred, and their consciousness returned. In other words, they were put under some form of hypnotic amnesia suggestion and couldn't remember until this came out under hypnotic amnesia treatment months later. What Betty did was remember much later what the symbols on that book were like, and this will come up as something interesting we'll talk about later on. And what you see up there, pictured, are what Betty said was on the front of this book that she was given. And this information wasn't published until 2007, because Betty's niece, a woman named Kathy Morrison, and a colleague named Stanton Friedman, wrote a book together filling in more details about this event that had not been included in the John G. Fuller book that came out years before. So there are artifacts, if you like, from UFOs, artifacts in memory. Artifacts are, in this case, remembered symbols that were seen inside the alien craft. Now that's a point that I'm going to come back to later. But what you'll realize here, of course, is that this provides you with some common features of the type of alien abduction event I'm going to be talking about. There's a close encounter, there's missing time, there's fleetings or sometimes more complete memory of abduction-like events, and then later there's either unaided recall, which sometimes happens, or aided recall, often but not exclusively with hypnosis. Now, I mentioned that word, and that should raise a red flag with lots of people. And the reason is, hypnosis is a very tricky thing to deal with. It opens the question as to whether everything that comes out under hypnosis, and a sizable, if not all, a proportion of the evidence about alien abductions comes out under hypnosis, isn't completely compromised by the mere way in which it's been obtained. And in order to understand that, we have to talk briefly about hypnosis. First of all, it's a process that's induced by relaxation and instructions to withdraw attention from the external world and focus it on oneself or on one very limited aspect of the external world and your own conscious experience. It has been studied systematically and as a scientific discipline, psychiatric largely, since the mid-19th century, although the first interest in it as animal magnetism goes back to the 18th century with a man named Anton Mesmer. The history of it is well recorded. It's been a part, but not a very central part, of psychiatry and psychotherapy ever since the mid-19th century. There are many notable students of hypnosis, including some colleagues of mine, famous psychologists like Clark Hull and Ernest Hilgard, who died just a few years ago, almost contemporary, were very interested in it and contributed a great deal to the literature on it. There are different degrees of hypnotic susceptibility. I know that because as a smart-ass 10-year-old, I was sitting in the audience at a hypnotic demonstration in my grade school class. My neighbors nudged me and said, go up, be part of it. So I went up onto the stage, stood there, looked at the hypnotist, he said, "Go back down." He wasn't having any because it was obvious I wasn't going to have any. You can resist hypnotic suggestion, and if you're not in the mood for it, you don't have to succumb, so to speak. So I wasn't very hypnotically susceptible at that time, but that doesn't have much to do with being smart or intelligent or anything else. Because one of the most entertaining hypnotic subjects in recent memory, and he learned to do it to himself, was Richard Feynman, the famous Nobel laureate physicist, who wrote a great deal about it in his autobiographical collection of articles, of basically chapters about his own life, written by he and a friend named Michael Layton. What is hypnosis physiologically? There's an argument as to whether it's simply cooperation with a hypnotist that effectively is no different than somebody simply deciding that he or she is going to be nice to the man who wants us to do things. Or there's some actual physiological change. The extreme form of that argument, and this is a very canned course in hypnosis because I don't have that much time, is it's either just cooperation or it's a completely different physiological state. What you see on the left here is Ernest Hilgard putting his shoulder on a hypnotized subject whose arm, as you can see, is in a bucket of water. It happens to be very cold water. She's supposed to be recording the amount of pain using her right arm, which is out of sight, on either a push button or writing it down. If she's under hypnosis, she's recording almost no pain. A person not under hypnosis would record very little pain. She is experiencing little pain, but when Hilgard taps her and says, some part of you is experiencing the pain, how much is there? Then that so-called hidden observer, a phenomenon that first came to notice in the 80s, is able to record the amount of pain. What happens under hypnotic anesthesia is interesting and shown in these pictures by some researchers at both McGill and U of M. I have here diagrams of MRA traces on the basically the parietal cortex, in which areas that respond to external sensory pain are either heightened in activity or reduced in activity, and that's the difference between them, when the instructions are not to feel the pain under hypnosis. At the same time, in the same person, you have an area in the center of the brain, the anterior cingulate cortex, which is either activated more if you're told to experience the pain more, activated less if you have, sorry, not experience the pain, experience the unpleasantness of the pain more. The distinction is between the sensory experience and the emotional effect. If it's emotional effect, the ACC is increased. If the emotional effect is damped, it's decreased, and that's the difference between the two. This is called a double dissociation experiment, very important in neuropsychology. If you demonstrate two aspects of a certain kind of behavior, and they each influence a different part of the brain, you have effectively eliminated a lot of other possibilities as explanations, and you can assert with some confidence that this is a genuine physiological response to hypnotic suggestion. So what we have here is evidence that defines hypnosis as a kind of state, one in which it's possible under instruction to change the way in which you experience the outside world, or in fact experience your memory of the external world and your own experience. Trauma will do that. There are clear evidence of dissociative trauma in hypnosis, and clear evidence that hypnosis can be used to restore traumatic memories that have been lost and produce the kind of abreaction that Benjamin Simon was doing in his research, in his experiments with Barney and Betty, if you like, therapeutic experiments, and also with the patients he treated in the Second World War. So, in summary, hypnotic amnesia is neurologically distinct. Hypnosis can produce reversible amnesia for personal memory, episodic memory. Hypnosis can increase recall from dissociated states. Hypnosis is one of several techniques of memory intervention that may increase or decrease recall quantity. It neither guarantees nor improves recall accuracy. And Verna will remember that I showed the same slide at a symposium in 2008 in Chicago on the same topic. In the audience was the world's leading expert on recovered memory, and she didn't say a word about it. In fact, she had no objection to it, as presented. Hypnosis is a memory tool. It does not guarantee accuracy of memory. It just can increase or decrease the amount that's recalled. Now, one of the things I want to do is point out to you that a phenomenon that's just one case is not scientifically studiable. So if only one person, let's say one couple, Barney and Betty Hill, had ever experienced something like this alien abduction phenomenon, then we collectively, as humans, as citizens or scientists, would be in no position to deal with it except as an anecdote. Something fascinating and head-scratching, but nothing to get our hands onto or get our minds around. But that's not the case here. We're looking at a series of cases very similar to the Barney and Betty Hill case that have been collected and analyzed over the past, well, theirs was 61, so what, more than 40, 50 years. And I'm going to review not all of them, but a few of them with you, remembering that when you collect enough case data, whether or not it's its observers or digging in geological time or whatever, you have scientific evidence. And I'm going to come back again to the question of eyewitness evidence in a short time. The first case I'm going to talk about, and there are about four of these, is Nyack, New York. The case occurred in 1969. It was written up in Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time, in 1981. There were three primary witnesses who went out after supper to go sit in a car and think about what to do next that night. They were near a reservoir in upstate New York. They consciously recall a close encounter of this. Actually, it should be second kind, because they were near a very large, hovering, low UFO. Then they woke up, they regained consciousness about 2 hours later and went to report the sighting to the police. They recorded when they came in and what they said they saw. One of the witnesses, had a spontaneous recall of an abduction spirit experience following that. The other witnesses one of them was hypnotized and came up with the same experience. So it was, again, a close encounter. That should have been a close encounter of the second kind. A documented piece of missing time, a aided recall of the abduction event later. Western Kansas, 1989. I had the pleasure of meeting both of the witnesses in this at an earlier conference I talked about in a previous talk. There were two primary witnesses, women driving back from a West Coast conference to St. Louis. They had conscious recall of a close encounter of the third kind. Again, I should have put that close encounter of the second kind. I was anticipating what was going to happen, but they didn't know that at the time they saw this. It was a very, very close encounter, clearly described, of a UFO within a couple of hundred yards of the road. And then they remembered nothing until they got to a nearby town a couple of hours later. They had conscious recall of missing time. Each witness remembered the same thing. Each of them was independently interviewed by a therapist named John Carpenter, as a matter of fact, who independently elicited under hypnosis corroborating reports from each of them about the abduction experience. And as I said, I heard these people talk, I met them, and I can't say any more about that than that, but it's a case consistent in details with the Barney and Betty Hill case, the Nyack, New York case. Bluff Ledge, Lake Champlain, not very far south of here, in 1968. There were two primary witnesses, conscious recall of a UFO, this time with a close encounter, because they recalled seeing a humanoid in the bubble on the top of the UFO. Then both witnesses were on a dock on the lake. The rest of the camp had gone to a swim meet in Burlington, as a matter of fact. Both realized that there was missing time. They didn't know anything between the time they saw the UFO and the time it departed and the people from the swim meet came back, which was about 2 hours later. They had conscious recall of missing time. There were supplementary witnesses who saw the UFO leave as the swim group came back. And years later, the male witness, who was agitated by this experience still, sought help by calling people he might, or looking up, basically UFO researchers, found one, Walter Webb, who's an astronomer at the Boston Observatory or Planetarium, and then he did aided recall both with the male witness and looked up and found the female witness who'd gone away by that time to another part of the country and brought her back and interviewed her separately as well, corroborating the abduction experience. Finally, a very complicated case, and a really extremely complicated case, is one that was published in the book Witness by Bud Hopkins in 1996. There were four primary witnesses plus the abductee. There are many complexities to this story. I will not be able to explain all of them in a short period of time. Basically, a woman who had experienced periods of missing time and had fleeting memories of something that seemed to have gone wrong in her downtown New York apartment contacted Hopkins after finding his earlier book, Missing Time, and realizing that some of the experiences sounded like hers. So she sought Hopkins out, and Hopkins was interviewing her about this when two other witnesses came to Hopkins, sent him a tape about their experiences. And these two witnesses were basically, although this is never said in the book, Secret Service agents who were guarding a very important international political figure in downtown New York on the same night that one of this woman's abduction experiences took place. They reported from their observation post, which was in a car under the the FDR freeway on the east side of the city, their car had come to a stop. They were driving this political figure off the freeway because it's too easy to assassinate people on freeways, and they were going to a helicopter pad at Lower Manhattan to drop him off and send him on his way. But their car came to a stop. They looked up, they saw the UFO over this woman's house. They described it as seen on the right. Another witness on the Brooklyn Bridge, which was just a couple of hundred, well, quarter of a mile away, further south, had her car stopped. She saw the same event through the grids of the bridge, as you see below. And another witness turned up further north in Manhattan who'd had a similar experience. In all, four independent witnesses plus the abductee who reported that she was taken out of her window on a beam of light with three little characters, who humanoids, who went out with her. And the Brooklyn Bridge witness saw exactly the same thing. This was an extremely spectacular show sometime mid, early morning, on the morning between, I think, November 30th and November 29th, if I recall properly, 1989. And the witnesses, this was a very involved, very detailed story, and I've only given you a brief part of it there. So, what about these people? Are they all crazy? No, they're not. Again, I'm watching the time, and so that's why I'm going a little faster than I would ordinarily like to. When abduction stories first began to get collected, and Hopkins was among the first people to take this seriously, he got nine of the abduction experiencers together, and they agreed to be interviewed by a psychologist. And the psychologist was chosen by another psychologist who was interested in the phenomenon. But the psychologist who did the interviewing was doing it blind. She didn't know whether these people were... She didn't know why they were there. She was given a cover story, like they were being interviewed for a job or they were considered for some important position, and they basically a sit-down clinical interview was necessary for each of these people. And she produced that interview for nine witnesses who were abductees. First, I'll tell you a little bit about the witnesses. They were, respectively, a graduate school college instructor, a college-educated electronics expert, a college-educated actor and tennis instructor, a graduate school-educated corporate lawyer, a college-educated commercial artist, a college-educated business executive, a graduate school-educated director of a chemistry laboratory, a college-educated salesman and audio technician, and a college-educated secretary. In other words, these were not bums off the street. These were people mostly around New York holding down responsible jobs and who had this common and collective experience. The interviews showed that these people generally had characteristics that they were intelligent, often quite accomplished in life, but they had, and I'm quoting from the report, a degree of identity disturbance, some deficits in the interpersonal sphere, hypersensitivity, and wariness. But they were not antisocial, and they were not unaccomplished. They did have something in common. They were a bit suspicious, semi-worried about interpersonal relations, and a bit hypersensitive. I think I might be if it had happened to me. A colleague of ours named Nick Spanos, who was a private pilot and who unfortunately died in his airplane a few years ago, was a professor at the University of Ottawa, at Carleton rather, sorry. He was a bit of a skeptic, and I wish he were alive today because he would be an excellent, what you might call, interlocutor in this subject. He did a fairly thorough study on the personality characteristics of people he advertised for in the Ottawa area. The ad said, if you've had a UFO experience, come to our laboratory, we want to test you. I'm sure they got some money in return. He also put out another ad saying we want people from the community to be tested in a personality study. In other words, he had a control group and a UFO experience group, and he found essentially no psychological differences between them. He was surprised because he essentially was a skeptic, but the paper is there, clearly written. He found that some of them were a little more open to the idea of extraterrestrial existence, not surprisingly, but that from a psychopathological point of view, aucune différence, nothing at all to separate one group from the other. This study that I have on the board here was done by some colleagues at Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. What it shows you is this is very hard to read, I see, but this is not so hard to read. So I'll stick with this one, which is clear. This is what's called an MMPI profile. It's a set of scores on different scales on a very standard, widely used diagnostic test in psychology called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. These are the scores of about 27, again, abductees collected through the UFO community and who agreed to submit to this kind of testing and send their scores back to Roediger et al. And he found two separable groups among this community. This set of black points here is basically a normal profile with one or two lower points, but nothing exceptional here at all. Like the people Spanos tested, who had no observable psychopathology of any kind. The other group were slightly disturbed. They had higher scores on various things like psychasthenia, paranoia, and what have you. Very much, that's the same distinction over here, very much the kind of people that Elizabeth Slater, the psychologist, interviewed from Bud Hopkins. In other words, either the UFO abduction experience leaves you unchanged psychologically, or it makes you, in her words, have deficits in the interpersonal sphere, be hypersensitive and wary, or score higher on the paranoia scale on the MMPI. But in no case are these psychopathological scores. Now, I want to tell you briefly about some of the research I've done, because I've worked with some abductees, not directly, but what you might call psychometrically, which means that I've interviewed one or two, but I haven't done enough interviews to say that I have a collection of my own abductees to test and analyze. I've worked with Hopkins and others on data they've already collected. Now, a long time ago, in 1998, Ted Davis, a colleague of Bud Hopkins, and he, Ted is a basically a social worker with a mental health master's degree, developed a scale, something like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which they thought would enable them to distinguish between people who had and people who had not had the abduction experience. Obviously, these scales that I was talking about don't, because they leave some people essentially unchanged. They developed a scale they wanted to call something like the Hopkins-Davis Abduction Scale, and I told them that wasn't a very good idea. They asked for my cooperation early on because they needed a psychometrician with a good computer and a lot of statistical software, which I had. I told them, don't call it that, because that gives it away. I said, call it the American Personality Inventory. So the American Personality Inventory it is. And people who take it as controls don't know why they're taking it. And so what I did to help Hopkins and Davis, they had provided me with the scale scores for the abductees, which you see on this graph here. And obviously, I'm not going to go into detail on this, partly because we don't have time and partly because it's too much detail. This is a set of scale profiles on various scales in that test for the abductees in a Hopkins sample. These are the scales for controls. These are people both Hopkins and Davis tested who had no connection with the abduction phenomenon, and people I tested, just to add to the control sample, people who are mostly Yale undergraduates. And since I got my undergraduate researchers to go into their own communities, I got a fair number of their uncles, aunts, parents, and so forth as well, so that the sample wouldn't be completely 19 to 21-year-olds. And then we did the same thing with simulators. I had other undergraduate researchers working on honors projects go out and tell the people that they wanted to, that I got them to test, including some of their nephews, nieces, aunts, and uncles, and what have you, that we want you to respond to this test as if you'd been abducted by an alien in a UFO. Everybody knows what the alien abduction experience is. They've obviously seen movies and stuff about it, as you will tonight. And therefore, there was some reason for people to know what that might be. So they filled out the test that way. And what they did was they exaggerated. They went far further on these scales than the abductees did. And so using psychometric methods, which are again too complicated to explain, but which I can assure you are above reproach, I was able to find 65 of the questions on this test that discriminate completely on a psychometric basis, quantitative numerical basis, between people who profess to have the abduction experience, people who simulated the abduction experience, and people who were controls and just took the test because we asked them to. So personality differences can be, or behavioral response differences can be found between abductees, normals, and simulators. Again, with data from Bud Hopkins, many people who have claimed to be abducted can remember, after the abduction, symbols that they claim to have seen inside the UFO. I showed you some of those earlier from the Betty Hill story. And now what I'm telling you is that I got a collection of these from Hopkins. I got another collection from a colleague named Stuart Appel, who hypnotized about 20 of his graduate students at SUNY Brockport, New York, and had them imagine a UFO under UFO abduction under hypnosis, and then afterwards, post-hypnotically, asked them to record the symbols they recall seeing in that imaginary UFO. So what I had was a set of symbols provided by Stuart Appel, which were generated by people who we have no reason to think had anything to do with the UFO abduction, and symbols generated by people from Bud Hopkins' studies who claimed to have been abducted by a UFO, or in a UFO. And I, again, subjected those symbols to a appropriate psychometric scaling technique. It happens to be one I've developed and published as well. But what we see here again is that the control people, the Stuart Appel symbols, are completely discriminable on various psychometric bases from the abduction symbols. This is the kind of thing the controls thought of. I don't show you the abduction ones that are from the Hopkins sample, first of all, because he doesn't want me to, and second of all, because he doesn't want me to for a perfectly good reason. He wants to make sure those symbols are not in the public domain so people can come and claim to have seen UFOs and have him believe it by reporting back the same symbols. But these were on the web anyway, and they're not unlike some of the ones in the Hopkins set. So on two psychological bases, one having to do, if you like, with personality or true-false responses to a test, and second having to do with what drawings people make afterwards, it's possible to distinguish people who claim they've been abducted in a UFO from people who either don't claim that or who claim falsely, deliberately, that they haven't been. Now here's a summary of this evidence. One abductee sample is within the normal range on the MMPI. Another sample is slightly elevated on the paranoia and depression scales. The MMPI normal sample is normal on fantasy proneness. The paranoia and depression people are a little higher on fantasy proneness. Several critics say fantasy proneness is the big explanation for all this. It isn't the right answer, but it does figure into some piece of that part of work. One abductee sample scores differently than either controls or abduction simulators on the true-false test. That's the work I told you about the American Personality Inventory. One sample recalls drawings from inside the abduction craft that are different than drawings produced by simulators. And this is something I haven't discussed at all, but with any luck, it's going to be discussed in a symposium held in May in Boston by the Association for Psychological Science. And this is, again, Hopkins' work. Many, but not all, self-reported abductees exhibit similar unusual scars in similar locations. And I won't describe what those locations are for the same reason that Hopkins won't talk about the symbols. But that's a very widespread aspect of the phenomenon. They've been subjected to medical examinations. The medical examinations leave marks. Now, what about the critics? I'm going to talk about two critics, both of whom I know, both of whom I like, and neither of whom is an ad hominem critic. In other words, they're not like the old Philip Klass and Donald Menzel story of the past. These are both psychologists. They both work in the area of social and personality psychology. And they both believe the following and have done research which they claim proves it. Alien abduction memories are best understood as resulting from a blend of fantasy proneness, memory distortion, culturally available scripts, sleep hallucinations, and scientific illiteracy, aided and abetted by the suggestions and reinforcements of hypnotherapy. All of those objections I raised before. Susan Clancy wrote a book called Abducted, Why People Come to Believe They've Been Abducted by Aliens, and Richard McNally actually appeared with me in a symposium on the subject in 2008. He's collaborated with Clancy. In fact, he was Clancy's thesis director and has published with Clancy and others research which basically suggests that if you get people in off the street, as they did around Harvard or Cambridge, and look for people who think they've been abducted by aliens, and that wasn't the Spanos case, by the way, he didn't say that, you get people who come in somewhat weird and who score somewhat higher on their scores of fantasy proneness and the like. So they have good reason to think that some people who profess to be alien abductees are simply suggestible, fantasy-prone people, but not all. I report something to you that I've reported again in the symposium in 2008, that Albert Einstein pointed out that logical thinking without data yields you nothing. Susan Clancy doesn't seem to think so. For a scientist, anecdotes don't count as evidence. 1,000 individual eyewitness reports are no more meaningful than one. I submit to you, and I will to Susan if the symposium goes through, but that's total nonsense. It's complete nonsense. It has nothing to do. Science is based on eyewitness reports, on evidence, on collected data, on corroborating that evidence, but the notion that 1,000 individual, similar, consistent reports are no more meaningful than one is just bad science. At any rate, what it forgets is something else. The McNally-Clancy approach is like the Procrustes approach. Procrustes was a Greek villain who lured people into his house along the road on the premise of hospitality, tied them down to his bed. If they were too long for the bed, he chopped off the extra length. If they were too short, he stretched them out until they fit. Didn't do them any good. Finally, he was killed by another Greek hero. I've forgotten the name. But the approach to the theory that they're taking is this. If the data go beyond the theory, chop off the extra data and ignore it. If the data doesn't match the theory, stretch the data until they do. So the Clancy-McNally approach is everything is suggestion or fantasy proneness. And while I agree, some people may fantasize that they've been abducted by UFOs and might succumb to a cultural stereotype in that respect, by no means does everyone who reports that experience. And by the time a person gets to what you might call a serious UFO researcher, those people have been filtered out along the way. Besides which, that takes no account of the fact that we know from these previous lectures that there are UFOs. Again, I report Susan Clancy's comment, which is nonsense. This is Philip Klass's comment. We talked about him last time. Both of these statements are, on the face of it, wrong. So they don't stand as objections to an abduction theory. And we know, on the basis of what you've heard here, that some UFOs are extraterrestrial. Not all of them, because some people do misperceive landing lights and the aurora borealis and Venus and what have you. But once we've gone through that, and the previous lectures took us through that, we have the O'Hare Field case, which I talked about. We have the New York 1990 case, which was also a UFO observation, as well as an abduction one. We have the Belgian cases, which are reviewed in great detail in the second lecture, and the Hudson Valley cases, which were also dealt with in the second lecture. And those are outstanding bits of pieces of both eyewitness and instrumental evidence on the UFO phenomenon. So, here I have a theory. And I present this as a theory because I can't yet prove it, but I'm working on it. Some people who consciously recall a close encounter of the third kind or second kind consciously recall missing time, and that's a common aspect of most of these things, spontaneously or with hypnosis recall an abduction scenario, have normal MMPI and fantasy proneness scores, will eliminate the people who might be subjectively less balanced than others, because this still includes a large part of the sample, prior to the experience, do not belong to a UFO abduction group, again to avoid the social suggestibility aspect of this, who recall certain symbols within the abduction vehicle, and who display an unexpected and unexplained scar or mark of a particular size or shape, these people have been taken aboard a vehicle not from here and have been interviewed, if you want to put it that way, by entities not from here. That is the abduction theory. And that's a theory that's basically espoused by a number of my colleagues and myself. That theory leads to a summary of what we've got so far. And this is the corroborating base of the theory, if you like. Observational data have been collected and studies have been carried out with some self-reported abductees. A direct interpretation of their observational data is that they've been taken aboard vehicles that we don't recognize as being from here and have been interviewed by entities that we don't recognize as being from here. The research data supports the conclusion that many of the people reporting abductions are clinically normal and not fantasy prone. And other research data shows that they score differently than either normals or simulators, that some recall similar symbols, and that some bear scars that are unusual, similar, or located on similar parts of the body. In other words, not only do we have a consistent report, elicited sometimes spontaneously and sometimes with the aid of hypnosis, we have consistent, observable, objective evidence. We have symbols that scale to match other people's symbols recalled under the same circumstances and are not like symbols recalled by simulators or people who don't have no experience with this. Many of these people, if not all, also have marks, scars, and other similar scars that can be predicted in advance as to where they'll be and what they look like, as can the symbols they'll recall, as can their normalcy in the psychological domain. We're not talking anything like psychopathology here. And this is a consistent syndrome. And it's not strictly an eyewitness. It's not just a self-report syndrome. It's, if you like, an objective syndrome as well. So from all of that, I leave you with this hypothesis. Some self-reported abduction reports are objectively true. And now I bring you back to a cartoon which was published in Gazette a long time ago. Even with the souvenir t-shirts, I don't think people are going to believe us. The next lecture is February 26th. Thank you very much.